Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Center for Strategic International Studies. I'm Andrew Schwartz with CSIS. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here. This is our second event of the season on this series. This series was made possible by the trustees at the Irene W. and C.B. Pennington Foundation. And without them, we wouldn't be able to really delve into this area of policy that continues to become so important for the United States and for the national security of the United States. We talk about national security here all the time, but this really affects real everyday people, as you could even see from the severe weather in the South today. We hope all of our friends in Atlanta are well. Mark Cooper of Walmart tells me that there are already people out deployed to help. I want to thank the Irene W. and C.B. Pennington Foundation, and I want to thank Walmart and for their support in this. This has been a real cross-sector partnership, and we're going to talk about that tonight. But we also owe a real debt of gratitude to the Irene W. and C.B. Pennington Foundation CEO, Lori Burtman, who's here tonight. Lori's vision for this series really helped us at CSIS think it through and put it into motion, and we're very grateful for that. So, Lori, thank you. Tonight we've got a terrific panel, and it really is going to get into these cross-sector partnerships where, you've got business and philanthropy and policy people here in Washington all working for common goals and to solve some really, really difficult problems. With that, I'd like to give it to my colleague, Stephanie Sanek, who is going to lead our panel. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. By the turnout on a dark and warm and humid and a potentially windy night, I thank you all for joining us. And for those who are watching on the web, you're just so you all know, you're being joined by some 150 folks on the web. So what we'll like to do is I'm going to introduce the panelists here, but before I do so, I wanted to let you know that this panel will run for about 1 hour, after which we will adjourn and there will be refreshments in the back. Before we start, I would like to remind everyone to either turn off their cell phone or set it to silent or stun. I appreciate that. Now, before I introduce our panelists to talk about this topic of public-private partnerships, I would like to point out that one of our panelists, and I won't name him, But asked me, all right, so if we're having a weather advisory in D.C., what is CSIS's evacuation plan? We don't have one. So what I will say, there is a wind and rain advisory that's starting at 9 o'clock tonight, so hopefully the reception runs from 7 to 8, so we can get you all home and safe and sound. That is my evacuation plan. But in the event, I do have my cell phone here. I get D.C. weather alerts, and if something happens, we will let you know what to do. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to our four panelists tonight. The discussion will be led by Dan Stoneking, and he's the Director of External Affairs for FEMA's Region 3. In this capacity, Dan leads a team to improve information sharing and coordination between FEMA and the American public. He has played a leading role in overseeing FEMA's private sector outreach and building working public-private partnerships. He will be followed by Ira Tannenbaum, the Director of Public-Private Initiatives for the New York City Office of Emergency Management. Ira is responsible for designing and implementing programs to maximize the coordination of corporate and municipal emergency management measures and resources in New York City. He also served as a preparedness specialist with that office's Health and Medical Planning and Preparedness Division. And of interest, he brings with him 14 years of hands-on experience as a volunteer EMT. Our third panelist is Mark Cooper, Senior Director of Global Emergency Management for Walmart Stores. Before joining Walmart, Mark served as the Executive Director of the Louisiana Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, and as the state's Homeland Security Advisor, following on the heels of a nearly 20-year career as an LA County government official. And finally, I'd like to welcome the most distant of our panelists today, Oz Ozturk. He was a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, where he supports the UN Project on International Disaster Resiliency in Switzerland. I'm just going to let that sink in. It's kind of awesome, especially as we experience 70-degree heat in January here in D.C. But Oz brings with him over 20 years of experience in management consulting, having worked for Coopers, IBM, and PwC in senior leadership positions supporting clients in a trusted advisor capacity. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this evening. Dan, if you wouldn't mind starting us off with the federal perspective, and we'll actually move in the order in which you're seated. Great. So you're up first, sir.
Thanks. So I have two baby daughters at home, and my wife used to be a real heavy sleeper. And now all of a sudden she wakes up, if they sneeze or cough, she's in their room in a heartbeat. And I asked her, like, how'd you make that transition? And I should have known not to ask somebody with a health studies background a question like that. And she tilted her head and said, well, of course, it's the reticular activator. I was kind of confused. She's like, it's that part of the brain that helps your brain focus on the really important stuff when you have thousands of competing and conflicting thoughts. Like if you want to buy a Jeep and you say, hey, I want to buy a Jeep, everywhere you go, you see Jeeps all of a sudden. And I was still a little confused and probably would have forgotten the conversation. But then she finished with, what's cool about it is if you set goals, you can actually shape your reticular activator and ensure better outcomes in your life. And I had that conversation as I was thinking about tonight. And for me, I think that's the key of where we need to go with the private sector, is establish real goals and do real things. I've been to enough conferences with platitudes and all the, you know, somebody will always say, hey, you don't wait till a disaster to share a business card. You know, we get that. But we need to do more. You know, working with many people in this audience and members of the panel at FEMA, we brought the private sector into 90-day rotations inside the inner sanctum. We did something. From there, we grew to a National Business Emergency Operations Center where we're conducting two-way information sharing. That's a goal and an outcome. But there's so many more that collectively we all haven't achieved. You know, I believe that we should look into a national database registry system so the Walmarts of the world don't have to learn 50 different states' ways of sharing information. I believe that we could have a concrete big business, small business mentorship program that actually saves small businesses, and we can track that more survive the next disaster. You know, one of the mantras in any enterprise is first you have to crawl, then you have to walk, and then you can run. I feel like the last few years we've been crawling and walking. I think it's time to run. I think it's time to establish some goals and activate our activator and do more good things on the planet. So that's a conversation I would love to have with all of you and the rest of the panel.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks. Ira?
Sure. Well, good evening. Thank you very much for having me. So what I want to try to bring to the table is the perspective of the local emergency manager, and in a way that's different from the federal perspective, because every single day we have incidents. Every single day we have fires or water main breaks that impact the private sector in some way, shape, or form. And so what we've been trying to do in New York City is build an environment where we can collaborate with the private sector across all levels, from the mom-and-pop store down the street who needs to get open, reopen as quickly as possible, to the Walmarts of the world who are going to bring resources from right now outside New York City, but we'll see what happens. But it's to the major events that we have that we have in the city. And I think that, you know, part of this process, and this has been one of the ways we've tried to shape the conversation. Many emergency managers in the past have really, when you thought of the private sector, their attitude was, you know, okay, what's the private sector going to give me? You know, what material? What are you going to write me a check? How are you going to do this? Give me something. And our approach has been, how do we help you be resilient? We want to make sure that the businesses in our city, the 215,000 small to mid-sized businesses that employ millions of people in New York City, are resilient and can get up and running as quickly as possible by sharing information, by bringing them into our emergency operations center, by making sure this is a day-to-day conversation that we know who they are, but at the same time being able to support them and give direction or give support when they need it. So it's been a process. We're proud of some of the programs that we've put into place. Hopefully those we'll be able to talk about that through the course of the evening. But one thing I did want to one thing that's important as we talk about the weather coming up is the opportunity for local emergency managers to leverage the relationships that the private sector have with your employees, right? The residents, the people who live in the city of New York are employed by the private sector, by businesses in the city, and that's a pathway for us to share information about personal preparedness, about ways that we can be resilient as a city, and that's a big part of what we're looking at in terms of building this public-private partnership in a way that's effective and that exists on a day-to-day basis and not just during a disaster or immediately following it.
Thanks. Mark?
Great transition for what I want to talk about.
Perfect.
So thank you very much. But also I want to thank Stephanie, thank CSIS and the Pennington Foundation, Maury, for this opportunity. You know, my experience with public-private partnerships actually goes back to the late 80s, early 90s in Los Angeles. And believe it or not, my first emergency management job was with the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. And we were asked by NBC Studios and Universal to come and put together a preparedness program for their employees. And then on with Los Angeles County Fire Department and the whole smoke detector messaging, you know, working with the private sector there. So when I took the job with Governor Jindal 2 years after Katrina, I knew that the private sector would play a role in what we were trying to do post-Katrina when all the eyes were still on Louisiana and all the things that went wrong. There were some things that went right during the response to Hurricane Katrina. So I knew that was going to be a big part of our arsenal. And one of the first things we did, and knowing that 2 years later, a lot had been done as far as government plans and responding to a hurricane, but the whole preparedness messaging, that was something that hadn't been done. And so we went to Walmart because of, you know, their reach out, and were able to come up with some very interesting collaborative things with them. One thing, for example, working with Louisiana pharmacies in the southern part of the state, and every piece of medication that was sent out included a message from the governor and from our Get a Game Plan campaign about what to do to prepare for a hurricane. And that was some 60,000 medications a month for Louisiana, and so that was 60,000 families that were getting that messaging. So, you know, Walmart and other private sector companies were very supportive of Louisiana. This was about 4 months before Hurricane Gustav hit, and it certainly helped us with the evacuation. We evacuated some 2.1 million people, and I think a lot of that was because of the messaging that was going out on preparedness. And one of the things that came out of that, too, was, and the governor's directive to me was, do not let happen again what happened during Katrina with the private sector. So we put together one of the country's first business emergency operations centers, where we identified, or we allowed people to become part of it, and it was utilized to get messaging, real-time situational awareness out during a disaster, and also to help resolve problems. And then that grew into something that was more formalized for the state of Louisiana. And Dan's been instrumental in the national business EFC. So hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk about that. But one thing just real quickly I want to say, in talking about preparedness, a lot of focus in public-private partnerships is put on response and recovery. But that preparedness message that you talked about, I think there's a lot of leveraging that can take place with companies like Walmart and even small businesses. You know, Walmart, for example, we have over 100 million of U.S. citizens that walk into a Walmart each week. So utilizing and leveraging that to get the preparedness message out, that's one of the things that we've really been pushing over the last year and a half. We're doing stuff with small business preparedness for our Sam's Club, millions of members in Sam's Club, and talking about what small businesses can do. We just got finished doing a pet preparedness event in California, again, leveraging the customer base that comes in to talk about preparedness. So hopefully as part of this discussion, while focus is on response and recovery, preparedness is a major part of what we're doing at Walmart, and it's things that other companies can do, you know, to assist with the whole overall resiliency, you know, that we're looking at this evening.
Fantastic. All right. Oz?
Your mic. I said you have a powerful voice, so your mic. Thanks, Stephanie. I think Mark was gracious enough to actually, invite me with the CSIS. And I guess why I'm here is to provide an international perspective. I've been running a project with the United Nations for the last year with a department called the UNISDR, and they basically create with member states a global policy for disaster reduction. So or strategy for disaster reduction, which started in 2005 with the Hyogo framework in Japan, which is up for renewal in 2015. And what I've been doing with them for the past year is engaging the private sector, which, you know, Walmart were gracious enough to also participate, and predominantly because the UN felt that there wasn't enough dialogue between public and the private sector, and they were looking at a way to improve that relationship, especially for the 2015 Hyogo framework, which will be up for renewal. So hopefully during this discussion, I can give you some perspectives. We've done these strategy sessions with a number of organisations who have a very large global footprint. The reason the private sector is so important is as much as government bodies and member states influence how assets or what investments are made in a particular country, the private sector really drive you know, the strategy behind that. So the resilience behind those investments is quite important. The other factor is that, you know, as Mark mentioned, there is a lot of knowledge around response, but very little, there's a lack of best practices around actually disaster strategy within overall business strategy, and that's slowly evolving. And the final thing I would probably state is that typically when we look at a disaster, we look at the human impact, the human cost. That's very well known. There are a lot of statistical models. But what's coming up now is the financial impact, and not just the immediate financial impact. Like when we look at Sandy, we say, okay, well, there was $70 billion in damages, but we're talking about the long-term impact. So people who have anxiety and they can't go back to work again. The small medium enterprise that actually can't reinvent themselves, and a family falls into poverty. When we talk about resilience, that's kind of the view that we're taking with the private sector.
Thank you all. For the audience's perspective, I just want to refer you to the flyer that you received when you entered. A little bit about the program that we are covering. This is the second of four events in a series sponsored by the Pennington Family Foundation that's, with support from Walmart, that is looking at community resilience. And I think it's great what Oz just went over, is that it's more than immediate recovery following a natural disaster. It really is about preparing the community, getting what you can in place before the storm even appears on the Doppler. It's before anything even remotely crosses people's minds about possibilities going forward. It's preparing the community so that you can be more resilient in the aftermath, doing what you can beforehand, getting donations in place, and getting structures in place. And to that point, I was hoping that Dan could answer my first question, which is, you mentioned the mentoring that you might encourage between big business and small business. We often see the private sector come to play immediately in the aftermath of an event. But a lot of times we hear about the Walmarts and we hear about the larger companies. What can small companies do, from your perspective, to help get them into the mix, so to speak?
Well, yeah. I think there's two major things. Everybody's talked about preparedness, and absolutely they should and could. And through FEMA, we have the Ready.gov campaign. In fact, the director of the Ready.gov campaign, Daryl Madden's here in the audience. The tools are there. But I think that's only half the battle. And let's be honest, most folks aren't going to wake up until it happens to them. It's easy to hear. We can tout it, and we should. But let's be real. Many won't react till it happens. And so when I talk about a big business, small business mentorship program, we work with the University of Louisiana and the International Association of Emergency Managers, Walmart and others, and we developed a platform that says, hey, sign up. And we've had about 25 big businesses sign up, and the problem we're at now, because it's a very new program, is we have to connect the dots. We need to walk on the streets and the communities in Sandy and say, have you heard of this program? Because you go to a website in 5 minutes and your business just might not be over. And so I think that is a good idea that several people contributed to. But frankly, I don't care if it's that platform or another. What Walmarts of the world don't really need a lot of help from the rest of us. It's almost insulting that the government's there to help Walmart. That's a partnership and a teamwork from day one. But those small businesses, if we don't do something, like I said earlier, establish a goal with a metric and a very specific plan and put it in place, then we're not going to move the needle forward.
I appreciate that. My next question is actually for Ira, because you mentioned that you all have tried to put in programs in place to help integrate business and the government, and I'm assuming at various levels and with various entities within the government. Can you talk a little bit about what New York has done before Sandy, after Sandy? We don't even have to mention Sandy, but what does New York have in place to enable those relationships to develop?
Sure. Sandy's a tough word these days for New Yorkers. But this goes back for several years, and it didn't just happen because of a disaster. On a couple of levels, the National Business Emergency Operations Center that opened and the Louisiana one, for the last 10 years, we've had the private sector sitting in the Emergency Operations Center with us. Industries like the real estate industry, BOMA, New York, the Hotel Association, the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. They've been sitting in with us as part of our planning team, as part of our regular engagement. What's been beneficial is, and we've been lucky in New York that my staff have been able to dedicate ourselves full time to going out and sitting on preparedness committees, going out to meetings and spending a lot of time with these organizations so that these relationships exist. But just to point to a relationship that a program that we started not long ago is our Partners in Preparedness program, which gives organizations the opportunity to come in, take a few steps, become an official partner with the city, and demonstrate. One of the challenges we've had over past years, and this goes to, one of the things that Dan said, small businesses. A lot of businesses that we've approached on the smaller side, we've gotten pushback. We don't have time. We're trying to make our rent for next month. We're not worried about the big disaster. We're worried about the small disaster of the economy. And so even the people in these organizations who want to try to push forward emergency preparedness really don't get have the voice in these organizations. So what we've been trying to do is empower them to give them demonstrable results. There's a seal that you can get from partnering with the city. There's something you can go back to your executives and say, this is something that we can advertise. We can tell people that we're part of the community and we want to stay here. We want to make sure that we can reopen. And so we're trying to give them. It's hard for folks to really demonstrate a return on investment for the efforts that they put into preparedness. And we're trying to figure out steps that we could show them right now that this is these are steps that you could take and demonstrate to your executives and to the community that you can be there.
So I'd like to pull on a thread that Oz raised in terms of community resilience in particular. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen internationally on the longer-term effects and what can be done to enable better community resilience, to talk in reference to things that you mentioned, the anxiety, kind of the long-term will of small businesses to try again?
Yeah, sure. Well, not just small business, but big business too. The interesting thing that we found was that we try to understand the context of, first of all, why that resilience was put in place. And when we talk to big business or small business, a lot of it has nothing to do with any sense of altruism. It's actually got to do with business continuity. And that's the fact of the matter. And I'm a big believer, if there's ever to be a greater public-private dialogue, you need to understand what drives people and organizations rather than just the... we need to be realistic to that. And we found, for example, whether it be big business or small business, if you create community resilience, that's actually a sustainable business model. So creating a flexible supply chain, creating a supplier network, which may be, for example, 10,000 hazelnut growers, making them resilient, benefits your business. And also their livelihoods. And we found a lot of big brands, I'll give a good example of Nestle. If you go into, say, Spain, a lot of people think Nestle is a Spanish company. If you go into Australia, they think it's a Spanish company. Unilever has the same perception in some of these countries. And the reason, because that it exists, is they've created that community of partnership to make them more resilient. But we've also found, diverging, strategies on how you go about establishing that and creating that value. From the small business side, I think you really need to go local. I think you need to make it real and pragmatic. As was mentioned, if they can't pay their rent, then you have to find the priority level. Small businesses, by their very nature, are extremely resilient. That's just the way they're typically built. So what they're looking for is pragmatic solutions, support, understanding what the response would be, what is the process, and having that level of awareness. And having the relationships So a lot of that you can actually streamline and provide in toolkits and for education, and you'll get a lot of, you'll get 80% of the returns you're looking for in doing simple things like that.
I just have one more question before I open it up to audience questions. But Dan, I'd like to ask you about the most effective public private, actually let me ask all of you very quickly, the most effective public-private partnership that you have seen in your career. And why?
If I had to pick one, I'd pick a program called Safeguard Iowa for a few reasons. It is a smart enough model to be funded through three different streams. They're not dependent on just one funding stream. They pursue grants, they pursue membership, they pursue money from the state government. But then they go back to what I started off this evening with, is they pursue meaningful outcomes across the spectrum. So Safeguard Iowa is doing good work in preparedness, they're doing good work in response, and they're doing good work in recovery, and they're doing good work in mitigation. So there's a lot of great partnerships out there, but that one does it all. And lastly, I think that sets them apart from many, is they have buy-in from all the audiences. They have government buy-in, they have corporate private sector buy-in, they have voluntary organizations, and they have faith-based. So many, many great public-private partnerships have some of that, but if I had to pick one because of all of that, Safeguard Iowa.
Stand out? Ira?
Am I allowed to pick mine?
If you tell us why, and then we can judge you.
Sure. And the model, and there are a couple out there, but there are essentially two models for public-private partnerships that exist across the country. Some are sort of this pay-to-play where the private sector collaborates. They come together and say, we need representation to emergency management. We need to get involved. And local emergency managers, funding is challenging. Most emergency management organizations aren't 180 people plus like New York City and don't have the resources to dedicate. So they come in and sort of show up to an emergency management organization as a collaborative but pay-to-play model. What I like about some of the other ones that are out there, and what is the model that we've chosen to go with, is that New York City takes funding, grant funds that we have, and instead of buying stuff or doing, we made the decision that we're going to fund positions so that we are open. It doesn't matter what type of organization you are, where you do business, funding stream you come for, we're going to come out, we're going to sit with you, and we're going to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important model that we sort of need to go towards when we look at funding coming from the federal government and grant dollars. How do we fund local emergency managers to dedicate resources to go out and do it without regard to who's paying the bills and who's making the donations?
Fair enough. Mark.
I'd like to just continue to talk about the concept of the Business Emergency Operations Center. I know during Hurricane Gustav, a great example was how that was able to help the state of Louisiana, is that when that hurricane came through and impacted the entire state, we had pre-positioned MREs and water to take care of the southern part of the state. And FEMA did an outstanding job, by the way, in responding to Gustav, partnering with them. But there was an issue of trying to get those MREs to the other part of the state that lost electricity. So one of the things that we did through the Business Emergency Operations Center and working with the Louisiana Restaurant Association, we identified those restaurants that could establish makeshift mobile food kitchens and were able to get food out quickly to the residents of Louisiana. That was a way to help government. And in fact, what we ended up doing is saving taxpayers some $1.5 million because it was much more cheaper for those restaurants to provide those meals than paying $9 for a meal versus $5 for a meal for the restaurants to do them. The other thing it did too was after disaster, it infused money into the Louisiana economy and to those restaurants. And to be quite frank with you, Louisiana residents, we like to eat there, and to have a cup of gumbo or a plate of jambalaya was much more appealing than an MRE.
Yeah.
And then from the private sector's perspective, and this goes back to the small business, is you've got to show value in these partnerships. For a small business to know that by being part of a business EOC, that they're going to get real-time situational awareness so that they know, and even in big business, know that if there's going to be an evacuation, I need to make sure that I'm making not only for your employees, but for this, for the business itself, if it's shutting down refrigeration, making sure you're bringing in, generators or dry ice. To have that real-time information I mean, that benefits, and I know from Walmart's perspective, and one of the benefits of us participating in these public-private partnerships, and in fact, we had just finished doing one with the state of New York before Sandy hit, was having those relationships in place and being able to go to those partners and say, here's an issue that you can help us with as well as other businesses. So I think the concept of the business EOC, I think that that's something that's working. In fact, Oz and I have spoken about what does that look like at an international level? Right. For companies like Walmart that have international stores, what does that look like?
Interesting. And Oz?
It's a difficult question for me because I risk offending my clients. But what I would say is, if I answer it democratically, is that we had a hypothesis going in that not a single organization or partnership would be best practice. We had a hypothesis that there'd be strengths in every type of partnership, and that's exactly what we found. We found some organizations, I'll give you one great example, a food manufacturer. There were floods in Pakistan for about 3 or 4 months, and this manufacturer teamed up with the local government and about 50 different vets. And the farmers had already disappeared because they had to shift, but they had 70,000 cattle in that vicinity, and that which produced about 2 million liters of milk a day. Now, if you don't secure the livelihood of that cattle, those farmers no longer have a livelihood. The company no longer has a sustainable business model in that country. So they actually flew in vets with helicopters for several weeks, immunizing the cattle and feeding the cattle whilst the farmers were away for 3 months. And then when the floods had disappeared and everything had subsided, it was business as usual. And so you'll find these pockets of best practices, and the key is trying to pull them together. The pharmaceutical industry is fantastic for hospitality agreements. So extremely vicious competitors, but if there's a fire in the local vicinity and they all for some reason happen to be next to each other, that they will share assets. Some organizations have these fantastic I call them it's like Houston NASA control centers, where they have complete visibility of their business, and those assets are actually available to the private sector, to local governments, to actually plan their disaster response efforts. So the challenge is trying to get these nuggets and get not just the public-private collaboration, but also the private-private.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure Walmart can learn a lot off some other organizations and vice versa, and that's where I see the real benefits coming out.
Great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm now going to open it up to questions from the floor. Just a reminder, if you could stand up, wait for the microphone to be handed to you. It should be on. Introduce yourself, give your affiliation, and above all, please ask a question. So with that, I will call on this woman up front here.
That's good advice.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Hope for Tomorrow, a nonprofit organization, and I'm also a profit organization. Looking at you all, looking at partnership, how do you look at the international partnering internationally? We have this disaster everywhere, Luciana, Cindy, in Africa, I come from Kenya. All this preparedness, how do you work with international to collaborate and work together as people, as we are talking here? I may have product to supply to Walmart from Kenya, but when it comes to actual shipping and the involvement, it becomes so difficult getting the products to the place where there is disaster. How do we collaborate? And then Walmart, what is the easiest or thing that you would see as supply to you as a small woman-owned company in case of emergency? Mm. Thank you.
Oz, would you like to tackle the first question?
How to coordinate internationally. I think this is where the governments play a key role, but they can also they can be a hindrance too. We've seen classic examples of private sector coming in and trying to supply water, and they can't get across the border because of some bureaucratic mess or safety concerns. or it's just uncoordinated, that they're too early or too late. And I think my advice in those situations is to, you can't avoid those institutes, whether it's the Red Cross or the member state, but the you need to work local. You know, there's no point in Mark sitting, in his office trying to make a number of phone calls to parts of, China or Africa. It just doesn't work. So what you need to do is have a corporate culture which actually creates empowerment in the local business. And they also have an understanding of the tools that are available to them. They understand the relationships, the business cards are already in place. If you're trying to react to something that is just happened, I can tell you, you're probably 50, below priority. Like, there are so many other, entities ahead of you, getting the treatment. So go local, establish the relationships, and then also have I guess you still need to have a central connection too. But it's not an easy thing to resolve.
That's a great question, and I would say that it's helping international governments to understand that small businesses, large businesses, can become partners instead of victims, and helping them understand that we should be part of the equation. Coincidentally, we actually have what we would call our emergency managers from our international companies in Bentonville this week. In fact, when I go back, and I want to introduce Brooke Brager, who's in the back, if you could raise your hand. She heads up preparedness for Walmart. So one of the things we're doing is looking at our best practices on what we're doing here in the United States, and we're going to be talking about that through Saturday to see if there's things that we could implement internationally. And not just to say that what we're doing here in the U.S. is the best, but there's things going on internationally that we could learn from here in the United States. But I think just helping governments to understand that we can be good partners and we should be during a disaster. And eventually what I'd like to see is, whatever it looks like, some kind of collaboration, like a international business EOC.
Yeah. Can we get this gentleman way up front here?
Hi, I'm Jan Opera with Opera Strategies and Solutions. Stephanie, you started out by talking about small business, and I wanted to ask the panel if they could give some examples of how large businesses or what they're doing to further the preparedness and disaster recovery for their small business domestic suppliers.
Anybody feel up for that one?
I'll take this to monopolize the conversation, but yeah. I mentioned Sam's Club. We have one of the largest listings of small businesses in the country, millions of small business members, and we're taking a leadership role as it relates to preparedness. We recently did an event in Houston for hurricane season that we're going to be replicating throughout the country, where we not only invited members but non-members to come and hear about the preparedness message and the great things that FEMA is doing to get them prepared, to tell them what they need. So that's number one. Number two is, during a disaster, a lot of best practices with other companies, including Walmart, to support small businesses. We, one of the issues during Sandy was with smartphones and no power. Mm-hmm. We actually had charging stations set up at Sam's Club for anyone to come in and charge up their phones. But the preparedness part of it, and then as far as supply chain, that's obviously very important to Walmart, and so that is a big initiative that we're working on, is how do we identify best practices or minimum standards that we'd like for our suppliers to have as far as preparedness. So absolutely, that's a big part of our overall strategy, as it should be for other companies. And and Dan maybe can talk about the mentoring a little bit more.
Yeah, it sounds like it would resonate with what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, I would just say one size doesn't fit all. Mm-hmm. And we learned an example in Joplin, this small little store called the Medicine Shop. And they were destroyed. It was over. And they were about to give up. And the owner of the shop talked to the employees. The employees were like, no, we don't want to give up. And they put a cardboard sign with a magic marker where they used to be. And they were like, nah, we're now here. He started calling all these different bigger businesses. And he got shelving from one place and some pharmaceuticals from another. And he got to rebuild through innovation, rolling up his sleeves, and hard work. But every small business needs something different. So the University of Louisiana and IEM, and I can get you all the website to this, put together this website platform where we reached out to big businesses and said, how about this? How about just sign up and say you'll be there and a small business can call and you can make individual relationships. Frankly, I don't care if you cut somebody a check, if that's your mentorship. I don't care if you send somebody down and teach them supply chain management. I don't care if you help them with preparedness. But if it can help a small business, will you step up to the plate? And within days, you know, Walmart, Disney, Verizon, Lowe's, I apologize, I can't remember all 25, sometimes said, yeah, we'll do that. And I would imagine, if this answers your question, Jan, every one of those, when we connect the dots, if we could connect the dots tomorrow with some small business in Sandy, every one of them would probably do it a different way. And that's okay. Because the goal isn't being the same. The goal is having more small businesses survive, and they all have different needs.
And contribute what you can to that end. Gentleman way in the back.
Hi. What would you ideally like to see from spontaneous volunteer responders? So people who aren't deployed by a dispatch center or a CERT program, but who are just in the area and want to help.
Hey, before we answer that question, could I just ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Jim Sweet. I'm a software engineer working on a public safety startup.
Great. What do you...
Ira? Well, I would say spontaneous volunteerism is great, and we're going to have it in any situation. But operating independently of the system is challenging when it comes to on so many levels. When it comes to safety, when it comes to liability concerns. So, what we've been trying to do in New York City is establish a pathway for people who are interested in supporting any response to go through one of our agencies called NYC Service. There's an open platform for them to come in and register themselves and share what their requirements are, what their capabilities are. But you know, from a city perspective, from a municipality perspective, it's challenging for us to deploy someone who we don't know or who's not affiliated with an organization because, quite frankly, there are a lot of challenges when it comes to background and for us to not do a background check on an individual and then send them to a shelter and who's working in our shelter. So we would always encourage everyone to become affiliated with some sort of organization beforehand so that organization can vouch for them. But at the very minimum, we've been trying to develop a system where they can come in and share their capability and get involved.
I'd like to point out Charlie Szymanski is here with the Red Cross, and that's a great organization to get involved in. In fact, Walmart partners very closely with the Red Cross and other organizations, in fact, embed them in our Emergency Operations Center. You know, one of the things, too, is that we're looking at is that obviously if we have a major disaster in our area, you know, we're known for tornadoes, as you indicated, in Joplin. You know, there's certain employees that won't be coming back immediately but might be able to assist, but be able to beforehand, as far as businesses, to identify that we have employees that can go and volunteer for organizations like Red Cross and Salvation Army and Feeding America and others. We think that that's very important.
Again, I think the key point here is if you know beforehand that you've got the volunteer spirit, register with an organization because they do take a little bit more seriously and they know what skills you bring and how you can better be used, which is not to put a damper on spontaneous volunteerism. Sure. It's just an alternative way to think about it. This gentleman right here in the middle.
Thank you very much. My name is Akshat Chaturvedi. I'm International Disaster Risk Reduction Policy Specialist. I've been working in Asia and Africa before coming to U.S. for Johns Hopkins SAIS. And my quick comment is that, and then I'll follow a question very quick, very small. Vulnerability reduction is basically the key for reduction of a disaster. And specialists go further saying that there's no natural disaster. All disasters are man-made because they are consequences of vulnerability. Often businesses invest into areas which are disaster risk high prone, or they are somehow, for their short-term goal, they are increasing vulnerability of a community. Originally, this is the role of national governments and the policy to be a watchdog, but it's not possible. Do you think, or do you really believe, that we should also have a private sector watchdog to prevent any other private sector intervention which enhances and increases the vulnerability of the community? And the second very brief question, if that's the case, how are we going to strategize to influence the Hugo Framework for Action Part 2, which is due by 2015? Thank you.
Actually, if I could turn both to Dan and to Oz to answer this question. Dan, from a government perspective, from a national government perspective, what do you think of the idea of a private sector watchdog?
So I think the ultimate watchdog is the American public. And they should hold all of us accountable, the private sector, the public sector, and at all levels. And by and large, they do. While I don't believe in any artificial additional watchdog, I think there might be value in the private sector coming together with a more national-level public-private partnership. So what we found is we got like about 700 of these public-private partnerships all around, and they all have different agendas. So there might be value in collaboration and coming together at a national level to bring all of them together under one umbrella to do good on the planet, but I don't agree with the idea of a watchdog per se.
How about you, Oz?
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting question. If we look at, you could make it self-regulating. The challenging aspect of this is that some of that know-how is also competitive advantage. Okay, so if you put your corporate hat on and say, okay, supply chain resilience is an example. Now, if one manufacturer is more resilient than another, that's actually an advantage. But what we have found is that every board that I spoke to, disaster management was one of the things that they were reviewing. That was one of the things they had to look at, all the mitigation strategies. So if I look at with the four walls of an organization, they're definitely looking at self-regulating themselves. That is still evolving though, as to, because the perception of risk is very different for every company. The Hyogo Framework for Action, that's a very good point. The one in 2015, the private sector will be invited. So all the organisations that have worked with me at PwC, they will have a seat, they'll have a voice at the table, and so will others. So the key is to actually foster something which is, I would say, somewhat self-regulating, but also pragmatic. So that's the challenge.
Yeah. Gentlemen. Right there. Thanks.
Thank you. Jock Menzies with Allen, the American Logistics Aid Network. Ira, you're a survivor of this, and you've worked hard in this space. What are some of the things that didn't work as you expected? Because that's where we tend to learn most of our lessons. I'd also point to the spontaneous volunteer. You actually had spontaneous organizations cropping up, such as Occupy Sandy. So that's a whole other genre that I think that has been emerging and that we're going to have to deal with.
Wow, what didn't work on the record?
it's closed room, isn't it?
I joke when I speak around in different parts of the country in different places that OEM really stands for the Office of Expectation Management, and that a lot of what we do in advance is trying to get out there and tell people, businesses of all sizes, what to expect, whether you're a large business to understand how our plans are going to be put into effect, or you're a small business to try to understand that there's no magic check that's going to be written to compensate you for everything that you had in your store on your say-so. So I think, certainly one of the things that we learned in seeing this is seeing how far our message has gotten and seeing so many people who've stood up and sort of seem surprised. So going back and understanding how we're getting into it. Another thing I would point to is really the intake management process, right? There's so many people who want to assist and provide resources after a disaster, and there's for a while there was this question out there in the industry for several years. Oh, we just don't know who to call. We're just not sure where to go. And so the NBOC and the federal resources were great. There was a single number that a national organization could call and get direction. And so I think we've come a long way in terms of people now know who to call and they know where to reach out to, but there are times that we have to say, you know, stop or pause. And, it's easier for us to do with the private sector because they can sort of control that spigot as opposed to the general public who seems to just, you know, if they don't have money that they can, you know, write a check, they want to, you know, fill up their car and drive their, you know, canned goods someplace and drop it off, and then we end up with trailers and trailers of, you know, unsolicited donations. So I think it was a challenging environment. I think we did a pretty good job in terms of bringing in resources, but certainly we can take another step in terms of making sure that we can manage those asks and point people in the right directions. I just want to also just add to this, you know, part of the challenge has been is that the balance between large organizations outside the city or even in the city who want to help the city, they want that sort of badge of honor of coming to support the government. And then when we try to push them or point them towards the aid matrix solution or toward VOAD organizations, it sort of wanes. Like, oh yeah, that's great. You know, we can write a check to, you know, Salvation Army or to, you know, Southern, you know, Baptists or whichever volunteer organization is busy doing stuff. But really, we want to support, you know, the city so we can get that recognition. And I think we have to try to figure out a way to balance that supporting any organization that's doing good and that's recognizing the city as our partners is really helping the city.
Thanks. This gentleman up here had a question as well.
Thank you. Alessandro Pio from the Asian Development Bank. We do get involved in a number of response to disasters of various natures. And my question comes from the experience in the post-tsunami Sri Lanka reconstruction, where really, if you look at the amount of funding available, the amount of non-government organizations, civil society organizations funding dwarfed what institutions like us, the United Nations, the World Bank were able to put on the table. And so the question is, here we have all the federal, local levels of government, we have the private sector, we have the international organizations, but how do you fit the civil society organizations? Because they are very active in the mobilization of funding, but when it came to actually implementing not the humanitarian response the first few weeks, but the long-term reconstruction, that's where they were not really geared up to that kind of engagement over a long term, and that's where some of the problems actually started coming up. So in this private-public partnership, where does the private nonprofit side come in, and how do you see them better playing their role?
Actually, if I could ask Dan and Ira both to take a quick stab at that. Where how do you play with NGOs?
Sure, I'll go first. So first, from our perspective, from the federal perspective, it's, you know, we don't play favorites. You've heard three examples here, and that's the area where I don't like to give examples. I'll tell you everything that went wrong. But I don't like to give examples of where money should go, because it should go to all the right places where your heart believes. There's somebody in this audience who believes strongly about pets. Then give your money to pets. There's somebody in this audience like me who had a friend or a family member who was helped by the Red Cross. Then give to the Red Cross. So it's not, and I wouldn't want to live in a country where the federal government suggests or advises where anybody should spend their money that's their money to give to be helpful to the cause. I think that in this room alone, we have so many good ways and places. The Center for Disaster Philanthropy, there's so many folks who can take money and do good things on the planet. I think you look to your own conscience to better apply that.
But how does the federal government work with NGOs?
Well, it's a little bit, and this could be a long answer, it's obviously a little bit more direct with the Red Cross through a memorandum of agreement. We have a very close relationship with them. But we have, in all 10 of our FEMA regions and in every joint field office where we deploy, we have voluntary area liaisons who are very experienced, knowing who all of those folks are, who understand the National Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster program, so we can bring it from the national to the regional to the state to the local, to help, my favorite phrase is connect the dots. Because what they do on the ground is those organizations come up and say, well, we want help. We got a truck coming in, or we have supplies, but we don't have a truck. And we'll go to Allen, another organization, and say, wow, you could fill that blank. We have this group that has a truck and this group that has supplies, but we can't get it together. So it's having the right people who understand the relationships at all levels of the government to interact, share information, so that we can get the goods and the helpers. But it's never about money.
And I would just add, I mean, you know, it goes back to the constant theme that you've heard over and over again, and then started off with, you know, knowing your partners in advance. Pop-up organizations, pop-up, you know, NGOs, that's nice, but if we don't know what you're capable of, we don't know who you are, it's going to be hard for us to assign you a job. There are plenty of challenges, and we have the VOEDs and NGOs sitting in our EOC with us, getting tasks, getting assignments, and we're proud of that. The challenge, and you mentioned this quickly, you said, you know, the initial response is great, but then sort of the next phase, you know, how do the NGOs support it? And that is harder. You know, the decisions about you know, building codes and decisions about recovery are going to be based on the public sector in many respects. And so coming out and supporting, making sure people have the information, making sure people know where to go to get it sort of translated at times is something that we're trying to make sure that our NGOs are out there to support us. Say, you know, come into the room, hear about, I'll use an example, the FEMA just came out with their advisory based flood elevations and, you know, the other day, and that's complicated stuff. And we want to make sure that our NGOs, who people trust and go to, can translate that into simple speak. What does it mean? Do I have to elevate my house? Do I lower it? What's going to happen? I think that's part of knowing who your NGO community is and how you can leverage their expertise.
Great. I'm going to ask the audience for one more question, and then rest assured we have a reception afterwards. The panelists will be present there, so if you have a question to approach them, I'm sure they'd be willing to speak with you. But one more question. This lady in green, please.
Well, thank you for the last opportunity.
No pressure.
I wanted to bring up the supply chain issue again and ask you, particularly at the international level, my name's Janet Benigni and I'm with the Department of Transportation. How can government and industry work together to assure the resilience of the supply chain? Mm-hmm. I think we each have our interests, but maybe we can put those together.
Yeah,
I'll take a shot at it.
I think the supply chain topic has been given a lot of thought. It was interesting, if we went through the global financial crisis, a lot of organizations actually made their supply chains what we call lean. So they cut out a lot of the fat. But that fat actually acts as a very healthy buffer. And those buffers were gone. So when you saw a lot of these disasters come through, there wasn't enough inventory or there wasn't the flexibility in the supply chain. So a lot of private organizations now or companies have have a renewed sense of energy in creating resilient supply chains, coupled with the whole sustainability aspect of it too, you know, knowing how many levels, rather than going one level deep in your supply chain, knowing your suppliers six or seven levels deep, doing supplier audits, understanding how resilient they are. So, you know, Walmart's, you know, does that. Many other organizations do that. So there's a lot of work being put in that area. In terms of how can you leverage that, one real big gap we see is, you know, frankly, the relationships are point to point. There is a real lack of understanding of what assets the private sector has that the government can utilize in that supply chain. For example, there may be a manufacturer who wants to deliver a certain product during a disaster, but they need the transportation. Their transportation network may not work, but their competitors may. The government wants to leverage that same transportation network with other organizations. So that level of visibility and planning is, unfortunately, like from my experience, usually point-to-point relationships and ad hoc. And, you know, the real value is to understand prior to an event, you know, or an incident, what those mechanisms and assets could be.
And I think for us, it's just like we have internal standards for our different functions, our business functions and business continuity, is we're going to be expanding that to our suppliers and hundreds of thousands of suppliers into Walmart. Mm. And to think that you do both separately, they're interconnected, because we can do all we can to make sure we're resilient as a company, but if we don't have that supplier available to ship those widgets, we're not going to be not going to be able to respond and stop. Yeah. So it's establishing those standards not only for ourselves but for our suppliers.
Right. And then just to add quickly, You know, it comes down to trust and that relationship. The understanding that the more that organizations out there can meet with emergency managers, meet with the public sector, and educate them about what the real impacts are of their supply chain, that makes it easier to make decisions during a disaster. And I just want to point to one particular example that happened during Sandy is, you know, New York City, a number of islands, right? We get shipments. We're the definition of just-in-time delivery for food, water, and all sorts of sundries and supplies. And you know, I get a call from one of our major partners, who's a major supplier for supermarkets, who happens to be based in New Jersey. They have big warehouses in New Jersey, but every day they bring in hundreds of trucks to supply thousands of stores with basic supplies, and they need a generator. And we've worked with them in the past. We understand that they've built resiliency, and this was a situation that overwhelmed them. But the conversation of being able to, you know, the potential for diverting a generator from New York City and putting it into New Jersey, and all sorts of complicated factors that if we didn't have this conversation before, we didn't know them, and we didn't understand what the real practical, you know, implication of their supply chain. And it's a different sort of supply chain conversation, I understand. Mm-hmm. It's distorted. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the more you can do to educate the local, the emergency managers in the public sector, that's going to go a long way to resolving challenges during an emergency.
Well, I would encourage everyone to join us for the reception from 7 to 8 tonight in the back of the room here. I would like to thank the Pennington Family Foundation, with support from Walmart, for allowing us to host this series and this event in particular. And finally, I would like to thank our panelists very much for being as honest and candid as you have been. And I appreciate it if everyone could join me in a round of applause. Thank you.
Great job. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Stephanie. That was good.
That was fun.